This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Hello, good evening. My name is Roman Bratiak. I'm with the Arts and Lectures program. It's great to have all of you here. Thank you so much. It's a great honor for us this evening to be able to present the 2006 Nobel Laureate, Orhan Pamuk, the Laureate in Literature. Mr. Pamuk has many cities that he can visit, and again, Santa Barbara's been blessed with his willingness to be here. So many thanks to Orhan Pamuk. There are a number of people I'd like to welcome and acknowledge. First off, Chancellor and Dilling Yang, who are here in the audience. Thank you very much for being here. I'd also like to welcome Hakan Tekin, who's the Turkish Consul General in Los Angeles, who's here tonight. Thank you very much for coming. Many thanks to Patricia and Jim Selbert for hosting a very lovely reception at their home. Thank you so much for doing that, Patricia and Jim. And two more people, Elizabeth Weber, who hosted a very wonderful session with graduate students this afternoon, and also I'd like to thank Giles Gunn, who will be handling the introduction and the questions this evening. The format for tonight, Orhan Pamuk will speak for approximately an hour. We'll follow that with a moderated question period, so we don't have any questions from the audience. We have collected questions previously that Professor Gunn will be asking. Then we'll follow that with a book signing. If you have brought books, that's fantastic. Just want you to know that Mr. Pamuk will sign all copies of the new book, Other Colors, but only three of the backlist titles. So if you've come with 12 books, that unfortunately is not going to work today. So pick out the three older titles that you'd like to have signed. Reminder, Borders is in the lobby selling copies of the books. Also, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones and keep them turned off throughout the event. And now it's a great pleasure of mine to be able to welcome Giles Gunn, who's a professor of English here at UCSB, as well as chair of the Global and International Studies Program. Giles Gunn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Orhan Pamuk is so closely identified with the city of Istanbul, which he has helped transform into one of the most famous urban landscapes of modern literature, that it takes some effort to realize that he has been more preoccupied over the years with the Turkish soul than with its great ancient metropolis. Nonetheless, I can imagine a writer as private as Mr. Pamuk would prefer to be, for whom the practice of writing finally comes down to something as simple as seating oneself in a quiet room to work by oneself, wincing at this grandiose assertion. But there is no doubt that over the years, his books have become an ever more important mirror in which the Turkish people can find something of themselves. More lately, they've become also an ever more crucial lens through which the rest of us can find something of ourselves mirrored in the struggles and divisions of the people of Turkey. Mr. Pamuk has published 5 novels with a 6th on its way, Museum of Innocence. Among those that have already appeared, probably the best known in the United States are The Black Book, published in 1994, My Name is Red, which came out in translation in 2001, and Snow, published originally in 2002 and translated in 2004. He has also published 2 books of non-fictional prose, the first being his internationally acclaimed memoir of Istanbul itself, which appeared in 2005. The second, his just-published essays, Fragments and a Story, entitled Other Colors. Along the way, his work has been translated into 50 languages, and he has received, by my count at least, 14 national and international literary prizes, the most important of which was, of course, the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2006. Whether we learned about his writing from a better-read friend or simply came upon it by accident, The experience of opening one of Orhan Pamuk's books and beginning to read has been similar, I think, for many people. Something like unexpectedly discovering a piece of precious metal in the sand during a long walk on the beach. Whatever book one first came upon, two impressions often dominate. Here, first of all, is a writer's writer who employs words, as he says, quote, like colors in a painting, identifies the responsibility of writing, as he states at another point, with, quote, the impish, magical games I play with the rules of the world, end quote. Admits even more strikingly, it's still a third point, that he writes slowly, quote, shaking my imagination as you might shake a pear tree, then picking the fruit off the ground, end quote. And yet, thinking of the second impression his writing makes, what extraordinary ground it is to which the fruit of his imagination falls. A world that, until we have read him, we almost think we already know, because it refracts oppositions, conflicts, tensions that seem also familiar in the contemporary headlines. East versus West, Islam versus secularism, tradition versus modernization, alienation versus integration, the local versus the global, indeed, Istanbul again. But it is just what we don't know because of such abstractions to which his writings introduce us that constitute the ground with which his imagination interacts. Among the many things we discover that we don't really know about the world his writing projects and illumines, I can think of three in particular. The first is what such a world as his imagined universe looks and feels and sounds and even tastes like to a sensibility such as his that is so strongly, even fiercely, drawn to its angularities and oddities and incidentals and opacities and densities. The second thing we discover that we don't know about the world that functions as the ground of his writing is how far back it goes in time and how far out it radiates in space, how vast its lines of relation and tension, how complex and various and often agonized its striations and discontinuities. And finally, a third thing that we may think we know but probably don't about that global world of his imagination with Istanbul at its center, its axis mundus, is how far down it goes, how much is piled beneath it, what vast entablatures of time it buries until excavated by a literary archaeologist of Pamuk's brilliance, courage, and moral discernment. Just one passage from the Black Book and its chapter, When the Bosphorus Dries Up. Amid the doomsday chaos, among toppled wrecks of old city line ferries, will stretch vast fields of bottle caps and seaweed. Adorning the mossy masts of American transatlantic liners that ran aground when the last of the water receded overnight, we shall find skeletons of Celts and Ligurians, their mouths gaping in open deference to the unknown gods of prehistory. As this new civilization grows up amid muscle-encrusted Byzantian treasures, tin and silver knives and forks, thousand-year-old wine corks and dosage bottles, and the sharp-nosed wrecks of galleons, I can also imagine its denizens drawing fuel for their lamps and stoves from a dilapidated Romanian oil tanker whose propeller has become lodged in the mud. No longer will we soothe our souls with songs about birds of spring, the fast-flowing waters of the Bosphorus, or the fishermen lining its shores. The air will ring instead with the anguished cries of men whose fear of death has driven them to smite their foes with knives, daggers, bullets, and rusting scimitars that their forefathers, hoping to fend off the usual thousand-year inquiries, tossed into the sea. As for the Istanbulis, who lived on the edge of the water, When they return to their homes, exhausted of an evening, they will no longer open bus windows to drink in the sea air. Instead, they'll stuff newspaper and cloth in the cracks to keep the stink of rotting flesh and mud from seeping in. They'll sit there staring through the glass at the flames that rise from the fearsome black chasm gaping below. It is a great honor to introduce Orhan Pamuk.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here. I'm in a book tour. It's fun to be here. Between the ages of 7 and 22, I wanted to be a painter. I chronicled this, wrote about this in my autobiographical city book, Istanbul. Then I stopped at the age of 22, as I wrote in that book, I suddenly stopped painting and studying architecture and did all my best to convert myself into a writer. For 8 years I wrote and finally get to be published in Turkish 8 years later. Then as I reach towards my 40s, I have decided to write about my years as a painter, or I set a novel that takes place among the painters. Tell the reader how it feels to draw a line and watch in amazement as your hand moves on the paper what the mind thinks and feels as if this is someone else's hand drawing a line. How it feels to be a painter. Also, project some of my feelings of artistic feelings as I also, at that time, gave so many years to writing. I first begin to write a novel about contemporary Turkish painter. Then I realized that this will be too derivative, that they are too much influenced by Western painters. And of course, the subject of Islam and painting is also troubled. So I decided to set my novel, leave aside my previous thoughts, set my novel in past. There was a brief, small art that we can refer as Islamic painting. Compared to Western painting, it's such a small thing because, as we all know, Islam and painting is a troubled subject. But then, although Islam do not allow that there be painting, it essentially focuses on that if you don't hang a picture on a wall, don't worship pictures, so forth and so on. So, and religion is also controlled by religious authority, but political authority is even more stronger. So Ottoman sultans, Persian shahs or princes, or Mughal kings did not much care about these prohibitions, and for their own sake and for the pleasure of their own eyes, allowed painters to put paintings inside the books. And they did not call them paintings, they called them illumination. In the all Islamic arts of the book, actually, the painter is not an important figure. The calligrapher is the important figure who gets the most money. But then there were painters. There were some beautiful manuscripts that were sumptuously illustrated, and inside there were paintings. So and this art had enjoyed its best, produced its best works in some 250, 300 years. In a book called My Name is Red, I wrote about these painters. Set a story in late 16th century in Istanbul, in which there is an atelier, various painters. They are serving Murat III in 1591. And the book, My Name is Red, has also philosophical aspects. Painters discuss, talk. And I wrote brief one-page stories to teach the reader about this art. But then how to teach, one very hard part of writing historical novels, that there's a subject that I research, learn, give love's labor to master, and in fact get informed, then the reader knows nothing. So how to introduce it? Then you can say, it was like this, it was like that. Then you have to be creative, and I invented these stories, both covering the subject and then a bit also, well, the story should be fun. Here is a story about painting and time, told by one of the characters. Let us imagine that this is a story told in the late 16th century in Istanbul, about another 150 years ago. It's a story told by Turkish Ottoman painter in Istanbul about Persian painters. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, yet not so recently, everything imitated everything else, and thus, if not for aging and death, men would have never been the wiser about the passage of time. Yes, when the worldly realm was repeatedly presented through the same stories and pictures, as if time did not flow, Fahir Shah's small army routed Selahaddin Han's soldier, as Salim of Samarkand's conside history attests. After the victorious Shah captured Selahaddin Han and tortured him to death, his first task in asserting his sovereignty, according to custom, was to visit the library and the harem of the vanquished Han. In the library, the late Selahaddin Han's experienced binder pulled apart the dead Shah's books and, rearranging the pages, began to assemble new volumes. Now I have to raise my head and say, that's what they did. And books at that time were not for reading or lying in the bed and holding because they were heavy. But they were objects of prestige once you get, and they were preserved in the treasuries, not in the libraries. Once you win over and loot another prince, another powerful person, you, along with the harem, you go to the treasury and get the books, throw away the binding, and then use the beautiful pictures and illuminations and texts to rebind as if this book was made for you with a new colophon. That's what they did. His calligraphers replaced the epithet of always victorious Selahaddin Han with that of victorious Fahir Shah, and his miniaturists set about replacing the late Selahaddin Han, masterfully portrayed on the most beautiful of manuscript pages, who was, as of that moment, starting to fade from people's memories, with the portrait of the younger Fahir Shah. Upon entering the harem, Fahir Shah had no difficulty in locating the most beautiful woman there. Yet, instead of forcing himself upon her, because he was a refined man versed in books and artistry, and resolving to win her heart, he engaged her in conversation. Consequently, Neriman Sultan, the late Selahaddin Han's belle of beauties, his teary-eyed wife, made but one request of Fahir Shah, that the illustration of her husband in a version of the romance Leyla and Mecnun, wherein Leyla was depicted as Neriman Sultan and Mecnun as Selahaddin Han, not be altered. In at least this one page, she maintained the immortality that her husband had tried to attain over the years through books should not be denied. The victorious Fahir Shah bravely granted this simple request, and his masters of the book left that one picture alone. Thereby, Neriman and Fahir immediately made love, and within a short period, forgetting the horrors of the past, came truly love each other. This is my philosophy of life, by the way. Still, Fahir Shah could not forget that picture in Leyla and Mecnun. Nay, it wasn't jealousy that made him uneasy or that his wife was portrayed with her old husband. What gnawed at him was this. Since he wasn't painted in the old legend in that splendid book, he wouldn't be able to join the ranks of the immortals with his wife. This worm of doubt ate at Fahir Shah for 5 years, and at the end of a blissful night of copious lovemaking with Neriman, candlestick in hand, he entered the library like a common thief, opened the volume of Leila and Majnun, and in place of the face of Neriman's late husband, drew his own. Like many Huns who had a love for illustrating and painting, however, he was an amateur artist and couldn't portray himself very well. In the morning, when his librarian opened the book on a suspicion of tampering and beheld another figure in place of late Selahattin Han, next to Neriman-faced Leila, rather than identifying it as Fahir Shah, he announced that it was Fahir Shah's archenemy, the young and handsome Abdullah Shah. Now, the rest of the story is one single sentence. This gossip provoked Fahir Shah's soldiers and emboldened Abdullah Shah, the young and aggressive new ruler of the neighboring country, who subsequently, in his first campaign, defeated, captured, and killed Fahir Shah, established his own sovereignty over his enemy's library and harem, and became the new husband of the eternally beautiful Neriman Sultan. All one page. I just published a book. It's called Other Colors. And there is also a little bit of a joke about the titles of my book. The journalist who never reads my book, but who is eager to do an interview with me, always say, look, only reads the titles and say, oh, Mr. Pamuk, you have so many colors in your books. Why? And also, a more imaginative one, what will be the title of, what will be the color in the title of your next book? There is also some substance into this title, in the sense that other colors are full of experiences and slices of life that I have felt intensely attached to. Always thought that in the end they will find a place in one of my novels, but I couldn't find a place in one of my novels, so they were hovering around. Of course, I wrote a lot. What Italo Calvino, he coined this word, a graphomaniac, a person who writes all the time. Not necessarily everything I write is beautiful, but you know, some of them I publish. I keep diaries, journals. Some of them I keep, most of them I never publish. Then for so many years, I wrote book reviews, cultural stories. I did so many interviews. And I also included little slight pieces of pieces from my diaries, also answers to various questions asked by magazines. Like any question, especially in my youth, I used to answer and also defend what I did to my writer friend, saying that, well, you know, we are working very alone, no one pays attention. At least someone is calling from a woman's magazine asking about what I think of bathroom curtains. Well, maybe I can say something, maybe. And I said. So, and I also felt that that these things, little slices of life, little answers to questions, represent some important part of them. Not all of them, but some of them. So I put them together in this book. Carved them, heavily edited them to form a one continuous narrative. That was the intention. Here is something, for example, I wrote about my wristwatches, because there was such a question. Someone called and, oh, sir, we are doing a page about wristwatches with artists, writers. Can we have your answer in 2 days? And here is my answer. I wrote, I think, in late 1990s, some maybe 8 years ago. I began to wear my first wristwatch in 1965 when I was 12. Then, in 1970, I got rid of it. By then, it was too old. It wasn't a fancy brand, just an ordinary one. In 1970, I bought an Omega, and I used it until 1983, This, my third watch, is an Omega 2. It's not very old. My wife bought it for me at the end of 1983, a few months after The Silent House was published. I've heard this from so many authors that I should perhaps make a note here, that most of the authors I know, and I'm like that, when referring to past times, just like people who refer to past as their, oh, I was in a secondary degree then, oh, this was my third year at the university, so-and-so, Kennedy was shot. We writers also refer to past as, oh, I was finishing, my name is Red Dead, oh, I was writing and publishing Silent House then, so forth and so on. A watch feels like part of my body. When I write, it sits on my desk, and I look at it a little nervously. Before I sit down to write, when I take it off and set it on the table, I feel like someone who has taken off his shirt to play football, like a boxer preparing for a match, especially if I put my watch on the table after coming in from the street. For me, it is a gesture that denotes a preparation for battle. In the same way, when I'm leaving the house, if after working for 5 or 6 hours things have gone well, if I've been able to write successfully, I very much like putting my watch back on, so much so that doing it gives me the pleasure of achievement, of work completed. I rise from my table quickly. As soon as I've put my key on my money into my pocket, I walk straight out. I don't wait to put on my watch. My watch will be in my hand. It's when I reach the pavement, when I'm walking down the street, that I put on my watch. For me, this is a great pleasure. All these things are merged in my mind with having struggled and prevailed. I've never caught myself thinking how quickly time passed. I look at the face of the watch, and it will seem as if the hour and the minute hands have arrived at the place where they were meant to be. But I don't think of this as an idea or even as a particle of time. This is why I shall never buy a digital watch. Digital watches represent those particles of time as numbers, whereas the face of my watch is a mysterious icon. I love to look at it, the face of time. In some ways, it conjures up that metaphysical conceit or something close to it. My most beautiful watch is the oldest one, the one I'm most used to. I feel attached to my watch as an object. This metaphysical affinity, this sense of enchantment, goes back to my first days of watch wearing in middle school. But later, it became linked in my mind with the school bells, and so it has remained for so many years. I take an optimistic view of time. As a rule, if a call takes me 12 minutes, I think I can do it in 9. Or if a call takes 23 minutes, I can do it in 17. But even if I can, I don't get discouraged. When I go to bed, I take off my watch and put it somewhere near me. The first thing I do when I wake up is to reach and look at it. My watch is like a very close friend. I don't even like changing the straps when they get worn. They carry the skin of my skin. In the old days, I would begin to write around 12 o'clock and work until evening, but my real writing time was between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., I would go to bed at 4. Until my daughter was born, I would work nights right through morning. During these hours, when everyone was asleep, my watch face would watch me. Then this routine changed. From 1996, I got into the habit of waking at 5 and working until 7. Then I would wake up, my wife and my daughter, and after eating breakfast with them, I'd take my daughter to school. Between around this time, when I was taking my daughter to school, I was also writing for a Turkish weekly magazine, weekly columns, the magazine called Öküz, and it can be translated to English as Ox, and I wrote about everything except politics there. My aim was just to be in that magazine because they were nice people. I agreed them politically, and it was also a good reason for producing fast, occasional writing. But after a while, I get bored. Every week, I would say, every Tuesday, there is a dog there. Every Tuesday, I would say to myself, this is the last time that I would write to this magazine. I'm tired. I'm not producing something interesting. I don't want to be more a graphomaniac. And I give them, this is the last time. And I would also draw some little drawings and then forget about it. Then next Tuesday around 4 o'clock, the phone will ring and I will answer, yes, sir, where is your article? And I would say, well, no article. This is finished. I'm resigned. And they would insist. Then I would say, I don't know. I don't know anything. And they would insist. And I would finally say, how much time do we have? And they said, we are sending someone to pick up your article in 2 hours. And I would say, and I also have to do something and fill the whole page. And I would be amazed. What am I going to do? And of course, deadlines are so productive things. Then, as we all know, then my imagination would begin to work. But then I confess that it's not my, most of the time, it's not the imagination. The slices of life that I have experienced just recently, anything that I felt intensely would suddenly come back to me, and I would write about that. In fact, some of these articles were loved, and my joke about them is that I am proud that I write slow, that I write meticulously. I'm very fussy about composition of my sentences, inner music, and the way a sculptor carves up something. I also carve up sentences, talk about them, so forth and so on, painfully write a sentence, and how slow I write, how meticulous and serious writer I am. And look at the reader, they like these fast articles I write in 2 hours. In those articles, as I told you, around that time, I was taking my daughter to school. And then most of the time, because of this helpless situation, I would write about her. But then, of course, it was also fun to talk about her. Here is one of those. I will read three of these little small vignettes, or I would say James Joyce would have called them epiphanies, little fast bursts of creativity and description. Ria is my daughter's name. I dedicated two of my books to her. When those books get translated, when the editor sends them, she makes it her business to open the first page and check whether the dedication is there. And then she says, this one had forgotten. Uh-huh. Now, this was now. But what I'm wrote about was when she was six, which was that easy to handle with. Every morning, every morning we go to school together, one eye on the watch, one eye on the back, the door, the road. In the car, we always do the same things. A, wave at the dogs in the little park. B, knock back and forth as the car accelerates around the corner. C, say, to the right and down the hill, Mr. Driver, casting a sidelong glance at each other and laughing. D, laughing when we say, to the right and down the hill, Mr. Driver, because he knows exactly where we're going, as we always take taxis from the same taxi stand. E, get out of the taxi and walk hand in hand. Second, after I have hung her back on her shoulder, kissed her and let her into school, I watch her from behind. I have memorized the way Ria walks, and I love watching her walk into school. I know she knows I'm watching her. It is as if her knowing I'm watching makes us both feel secure. First, there is a world she enters and explores every day, and then there is the world we two share. When I watch her and she turns around to watch me, we keep our world going. But then she breaks into a run and enters a new life where my eyes cannot go. Three, let me brag a little. My daughter is intelligent and knows what she likes. She insists without a moment's hesitation that I tell the best stories, and on weekend mornings she lies down next to me and demands her due. Because she knows who she is, she knows what she wants. Quote, it shouldn't be a witch again. She should escape from prison, but she couldn't go blind, and she couldn't grow old, and in the end, she shouldn't catch the little child. She doesn't want me skipping the part she likes. She tells me which parts she doesn't like while I'm still telling the story. This is why telling her a story means both writing it and reading it as the child who wrote it. Four, as with all intimate relationships, ours is a power struggle. Who will decide, A, which channel to watch on television? B, what time is bedtime? C, what game will be played or not played, and how this decision and many other similar decisions, discussions, disputes, tricks, sweet deceptions, bouts of tears, rebukes, sulks, reconciliations, and acts of contrition will be resolved after long political negotiations. All this effort makes us tired and happy, but in the end, it accumulates and becomes the history of the relationship, the friendship. You come to an understanding because you're not going to give up on each other. You think about each other, and when you're parted, you remember each other's smell. When she is gone, I miss the smell of her hair terribly. When I'm gone, she smells my pajamas. Another piece about confusion, what a father sees, when Ria is sad. These pieces I wrote weekly, and they are the best of them. Sometimes I wrote bad. Do you know what, darling? When you're this sad, I'm sad too. I feel as if there is this instinct buried somewhere deep inside me, in my body, my soul, well, somewhere. When I see you sad, I get sad. It's as if some computer inside me says, when you see that Ria is sad, you get sad too. I can get sad for no reason too, and just as suddenly. I can be in the middle of an ordinary day, tending to the refrigerator or the paper or my mind or my hair. My mind goes off on a tangent, this life, but let's stop for a moment. I look at Ria, and her face is dark and clouded. She's curled up on the divan, just lying there. What's made her so unhappy? Watching the world from the corner of her eye, and her father watching her watch the world. In one hand is a blue rabbit. On her other hand, she is resting her unhappy face. I walk back to the kitchen to rummage through the drawers of the refrigerator and my mind. What could it be, I wonder? Does she have a stomachache? Or maybe she is discovering the taste of her melancholy. Let her be sad, let her lose herself in solitude and her own smell. The first aim of an intelligent person is to achieve unhappiness when everyone around her is happy. So once I thought. I'd like it when people say Borgesian things. Indeed, I try whenever possible to be as unhappy as all young people. That's good, but beware, she is not a young person yet. She's a child. Silence. I open the refrigerator, pick up a huge, bright red apple and bite into it as hard as I can. I leave the kitchen. She is still lying there in a bowl. I pause to think. Make an approach. Say, come, let's play dice. And where's the box? Find the box. And as you open it, ask each other, what color are you going to be? I'm green. Okay, then, I'll be red. Then throw the dice, count the squares, and make sure she wins. If she starts wanting to win, if she starts enjoying herself, she'll brighten up and say, I'm winning. So take the lead then, win every game. Sometimes I get fed up. I think, let me win, even if it's just once. Let this girl learn how to lose. It doesn't work. She throws away the dice. She overturns the game board. She goes off to sulk in the corner. Why don't I suggest a game of stay off the floor? You can go from the table to the dining chairs, from the dining chairs to the armchairs, the divan, the other table, the side of the radiator. You can touch the floor, but if you get caught with your foot on the floor, you're it. But don't try to jump too far. The best game is chase. All around the house, around the table, from room to room, around the dining chairs, while the television drones on about the latest paradises, coups, rebellions and beauty contests, and the dollar, and the stock exchange. And look at us, see how we're chasing each other and paying no attention to you and all your nonsense. As we run about madly, overturning baskets, knocking over lamps, crashing castles of newspaper piles, coupons and cardboard, starting to sweat, shouting, but without knowing what exactly we're shouting about, we sometimes take off our clothes. If only you knew how fast we can run over chocolate wrappers, coloring books, broken toys, old newspapers, discarded water bottles, slippers and boxes. But I couldn't even do this. I sat in a corner and watched the color of dirt settling quietly over the roar of the city. The television was on, but there was no sound, none at all. One of those seagulls was walking slowly across the roof. I recognized its patter. The two of us gazed out the window without speaking for the longest time, I in my chair and Ria on the divan, and we both, Ria sadly, I with joy, thought about how beautiful it was. Another one, last piece about me and her. But then this is the most anthologized and most loved one. And I haven't done anything. I just recorded her monologue. Again, they were asking for the article. This is an earlier one. Me and her. As I wrote in my Istanbul book, I used to cut school in high school. Here is my daughter's monologue. I'm not going to school. I'm not going to school because I'm sleepy. This was the first year of school for her. Because I'm sleepy, I'm cold, no one likes me at school. I'm not going to school because there are two children there. They are bigger than me. They are stronger than me. When I go past them, they stick out their arms and block my way. I'm afraid. I'm not going to school. At school, time just stops. Everything gets left outside the school door. My room at home, for example, also my mother, my father, my toys, and the birds on the balcony. When I'm at school and I think about them, I want to cry. I look out the window. In the sky outside, there are clouds. I'm not going to school because I don't like anything there. The other day, I did a picture of a tree. The teacher said, "That's really a tree. Well done." I did another one. This one had no leaves either. Then one of those children came over and made fun of me. "I'm not going to school. When I go to bed at night and I think about going to school the next day, I feel terrible." I say, "I'm not going to school." They say, "How can you say that? Everyone goes to school." "Everyone? So let everyone go then." "What's going to happen if I stay home? I went yesterday, didn't I? How about if I don't go tomorrow and then go the day after that?" If only I were at home in my bed or in my room. If only I were anywhere but that school. "I'm not going to school. I'm sick. Can't you see? The moment someone says school, I feel sick. I get a stomachache. I can't even drink that milk. I'm not going to drink that milk. I'm not going to eat anything. And I'm not going to school either. I'm so upset. No one likes me. There are those two children. They stick out their arms and block my way." I went to the teacher. The teacher said, "Why are you following me?" "I'll tell you something if you promise not to get mad. I'm always following the teacher, and the teacher is always saying, 'Don't follow me.'" "I'm not going to school ever again." "Why?" "Because I just don't want to go to school, that's why. When it's recess, I don't want to go outside either. Just when everyone's forgotten me, then it's recess. Then everything gets all mixed up. Everyone starts running." The teacher gives me a nasty look, and she doesn't look too good to start with. "I don't want to go to school. There is one child who likes me. He's the only one who looks at me nicely. Don't tell anyone, but I don't like that child either." I just sit down and stare there. I feel so lonely. Tears run down my cheeks. I don't like school at all. "I don't want to go to school," I say. Then it's morning and they take me to school. I can't even smile. I look straight in front of me. I want to cry. I climb up the hill with a bag on my back that is as big as soldiers, and I keep my eyes on my little feet as they climb the hill. Everything is so heavy. The bag on my back, the hot milk in my stomach. I want to cry. I walk into school. The black metal garden gate closes behind me. I cry, "Mommy, look, you left me inside. Then I go into my classroom and sit down. I want to become one of those clouds outside. Erasers, notebooks, and pens feeds them to the hens. That's translated by, very well translated by Maureen Freely. This book has also occasional writings, prize acceptance speeches, book reviews, lots of articles about the writers I like, such as Dostoevsky, Nabokov, others. Selections from interviews, from books such as Snow, My Name is Red, and also other articles about these books, how I wrote them, so forth and so on. The most popular question we authors have always faced is that, why do you write? For what do you write? Here in one lecture, I have tried to give an answer to that. There is not one single answer. And I made a list of various answers, a sort of a poetic answer. I like lists, and I sometimes think of novels as drama and a series of lists. Here's a list trying to answer the question. As you know, the question we writers asked most often, the favorite question is, why do you write? I write because I have an innate need to write. I write because I can't do normal work like other people. I write because I want to read books like the ones I write. I write because I am angry at all of you, angry at everyone. I write because I love sitting in a room all day writing. I write because I can only partake in real life by changing it. I write because I want others, all of us, the whole world, to know what sort of life we lived and continue to live in Istanbul, in Turkey. I write because I love the smell of paper, pen, and ink. I write because I believe in literature, in the art of the novel, more than I believe in anything else. I write because it's a habit, a passion. I write because I'm afraid of being forgotten. I write because I like the glory and interest that writing brings. I write to be alone. Perhaps I write because I hope to understand why I am so very, very angry at all of you, so very, very angry at everyone. I write because I'd like to be read. I write because once I have begun a novel, an essay, a page, I want to finish it. I write because everyone expects me to write. I write because I have a childish belief in the immortality of libraries and in the way my books sit on the shelf. I write because it is exciting to turn all of life's beauties and riches into words. I write not to tell a story, but to compose a story. I write because I wish to escape from the foreboding that there is a place I must go, but just as in a dream, I can't quite get there. I write because I have never managed to be happy. I write to be happy. Hey.
You have been the beneficiary of great translations, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Translation is, however, for you as well, it seems to me, a larger, a more profound kind of issue, because you are also trying to translate experiences you've had, knowledges you possess, into the idioms of other people's understanding. How do you think about the problem of translation, not just of your books, but of those kinds of processes?
Referring to what you refer as those kind of processes, I understand there's also something called cultural translation. That say, if in Anna Karenina we see that one main character is reading a newspaper, then, and if we have a footnote which tells us that newspaper is a liberal one, then we understand like this, that our character is a liberal guy, contrary to say, monarchist or conservative Russian. Or if in my novel set in, say, 1980s, if a character reads a newspaper, Turkish reader immediately understands his political views, or at least there is some information about that. But what if, how would Polish reader would understand these details? They wouldn't. And some of these, it's hard to translate everything. Sometimes I try to do it, go, say to myself, well, you know, Turkish, what the Polish reader don't understand, Turkish reader in 30 years will not understand either, right? Because mm-hmm. The new generation will not remember what is the newspapers anyway. So many things that I wrote in my early books, some of the new generations are coming, are looking at me blank like the Polish reader. So there should always be an attempt to translate the culture as well as the language. But of course, the hardest thing is translating the text. I can only check English. I meticulously check English. Up to now, I had 4 English translators. For the last, the last one is Maureen Freely, did 4 books. In fact, I'm young now, but one of my books has already been translated to English twice, the Black Book. There was an earlier translation. Mm-hmm. Then Vintage did another translation. We are working very well with Maureen Freely, and our method of working is more or less was the same with other translators. That is, the translator does the translation. He or she mails me to the translation to Istanbul. I very carefully begin reading the translation. In the fifth page, I have a depression. Why? It's like beginning of a new novel that I'm writing. I just can't agree with the voice. Each novel is made up of essentially discovering a voice that will hold the whole story together. And then once, then it's hard to first to invent that voice when you start a novel. And also, it's hard to accept that voice in another language, which seems very artificial and strange. But then you have to accept it. After a time passes, 2 months, 3 months, I take notes and talk, and then I accept it. Then we meet most of the time. Maureen comes to Istanbul. Her parents are living in Istanbul. And we sit at a table, go over all these issues that I took down notes about. We argue, we quarrel, we discuss, we sometimes laugh, we find solutions, we delete things. Translation is also about making fast decisions about the length of the text. There are so many meanings, side meanings of a sentence. Some of them, if you don't want your translation twice as long as the original, you have to make decisions. In Turkish, with 2 letters, not 2 words, I can say a lot sometimes. But then the cost of these 2 meanings is only 2 letters. I say, because it's cheap. But then if I want that thing in English, then I have to have, if I need 3 words, I don't want that meaning. But if it's essential, I want that meaning. A sentence is like a machine, carries the heavy artillery, then there are small little things around. So you have to make fast decisions. You cannot talk about each sentence for 3 hours. So the translator should have an instinct to go at the heart of the sentence, look at the inner music, how it will be attached to the next sentence. The thing will go smoothly, so forth and so on. We argue and argue. Sometimes we can just make a decision because we're tired about what we're talking about. Sometimes Maureen says, okay, I'll find a solution at home, okay? So we get move to the next problem. The funniest thing is that sometimes if she says something and I say something, there's a little bit of an argument and she gets upset about my insistence and says, you just can't say that in English, which finishes me off. That's a hard argument. Or sometimes, this is the best part I like, then we agree about all the words, expressions inside a sentence or 1 or 2 sentences, but then there is something missing, the inner music. And then I say, look, these words and these words, and these words should be... Then she said, okay, and does it. So I think the inner music of the translation is also very important.
You were the first writer in the Muslim world to publicly condemn the fatwa against Salman Rushdie, and yet years later you have also been the focus of criticism for comments in Turkey about the death of Kurds and Armenians. Has this had an effect on your views about free speech? Or
no. Then this had... when I was making those comments, simply because I get angry and say things. I do not have a straight political aim, a moral agenda, or, you know, as some politically, hardly politically motivated people, a political agenda. I just say it because I feel that's true, that I get angry and say this. Then I'm in trouble, you know, there are campaigns, trials, or there sometimes nothing happens, of course. Then I'm in trouble. Then I embrace the idea of free speech because only free speech people defend me in hard times. When I'm alone and everyone was attacking and I felt not happy with my situations, for example, only first international and Turkish pen defended. Then that makes one a more stronger defender of free speech. I defend free speech, of course, because it's moral. It has to be defended. There is no modern society without free speech, no open society without free speech, and also free speech defends me too.
This may be a good place to end.
Yes, okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Orhan Pamuk.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.